Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is One Heat Minute.
Drop of a hat, these guys were rock and roll.
What's your name?
Wayne Grove.
Look like gangbangers working the local 7-Eleven. Robbery, homicides, take it out.
Give me all you got! Listen. Give me all you got!
I do what I do best. I take scores. You do what you do best. I'm trying to stop guys like you.
A podcast dedicated to all 170 minutes of Michael Mann's LA crime opus Heat, 1 minute at a time.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Heat Minute, podcast about Michael Mann's 1995 crime opus Heat, unpacking, digging into every single minute sequentially. But we're way out of sequence at this point. There are 166 pre-credits minutes of Heat. This is nearly the 200th episode, and the show usually sits dormantly in the garage waiting if I just ever want to turn it over again. And if you listen to a fantastic bonus episode of our show, The Decade Project, I talked to Academy Award-winning screenwriter Graham Moore, who was so kind to make the introduction today and also to be here. Not one, but two Academy Award-winning voices on the other line you're going to hear. I've spoken to Graham, of course, Academy Award-winning screenwriter of The Imitation Game, had a wonderful conversation with him. He is here. But ladies and gentlemen, there is someone that Graham brought to the show who is particularly special. This is the editor of The Insider, of Ali, of Miami Vice. Yes, that's right. 2006's Miami Vice. Pleasantville was duly nominated and won in the same year for both Argo and Zero Dark 30. Domino for you Tony Scott heads out there. But most importantly, he is one of the four-man team of head chief editors who edited Michael Mann's Heat. Ladies and gentlemen, please... be upstanding wherever you are. You're on a train, you're in your car, pull over. It's William Goldenberg. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you.
To the show. Thank you so much for being here. And Graham, thank you so much for making this happen. This is amazing.
Well, thanks for having me. I mean, I appreciate it. I've been listening to this show for a couple of years now. So it's exciting to actually be here.
It scares me and freaks me out very slightly when people such as yourself say they've listened to the show. I liked it better when I was just the weird guy in Australia who had no idea who was listening to this thing, but it's really heartening. And thank you so much, Graham. Last time we talked, we did everything in our power to stay on topic, to talk about your sensational film of which Bill edited, that you wrote for your Academy Award, Imitation Game, to not talk about Heat while we were talking about that conversation and about the great lessons that you learned from Bill. But I just want to say thank you for being here as well. You get to participate in Bill's Minute. This is a weird one. Usually I've talked to kind of both people about what minute they're going to choose, but we are doing this old school style. We are going with a minute of the film. And did you see what Bill had responded, that his minute was going to be of the show?
No, I didn't see it. So I'm going to find out as we watch it. I'm really excited about this. I think, as I've said, I've now gotten to work on two films with Mr. Goldenberg here. And so I'm so excited to, I feel like the hardest part of working on those films was not asking him questions about Heat. So now I get a venue to finally ask all the questions that have been dying to ask all this time.
All right. Well, if this is the first time you ever listen to the show, what we usually do is I floridly introduce my amazing guests, as we do. But then we take a look at a minute of the film. But in the original run of the show, it was easy. It was sequential. We were tracking from the beginning to the end. But this minute is truly the most sought after minute that we'd ever done on the show. I think I had a total of 9 or 10 people at the time we were recording say, I want to do that minute. And at the time, you know, friend of the show, Matt Zoller-Zeitz, editor at RogerEbert.com and TV writer at Vulture had a mortgage on that minute. So I didn't do it multiple times. But the minute in question is minute 147, which is 2 hours and 26 minutes to 2 hours and 27 minutes in the film. And I'm going to let Bill talk about why this is significant after we listen to it, but we're going to watch and listen along together. You guys are going to listen along, and then we're going to come back. We're going to talk about it.
You asked, so I got to tell you. The guy you wanted checked into the Hotel Marquis under Jameson, if you still give a shit, which I figured you wouldn't.
You figured right.
So long, brother. You take it easy. You're home free.
Take it easy.
Okay, I cheated. Why did I cheat? Because I just can't help watch that 7 seconds, seven more seconds of Robert De Niro's face deliberating over the life-changing, one of many life-changing decisions he's made in the conclusion of this sensational movie. Bill, can you please tell me why you selected that minute for us to talk about today?
Mostly for what you just said. I mean, it was that acting was very early when I came onto the film. I came onto the film the last day of shooting.
Wow.
And
when was that?
One of the first, what's that?
When was that? Because what? it was
well,
October,
there were three editors on the film. There were three editors on the film, Tom Rolfe, Pat Pasquale Buba, and Dov Honig, who was Michael's editor for several years before that. And Tom had to leave the film for another film, and Michael was looking for another editor to join the film. And he had seen a television movie I cut that he really loved and knew the writer-director of that, and called me to interview with him, and he hired me, and it was just an overwhelming sense of fear when I got hired, because it was the third or fourth thing I'd ever done as an editor. And it was one of those things where I remember seeing the two of them on the Oscars that year presenting an award and thinking maybe in 10 years or so I get to work on a film like that. And then like a couple of months later, I was on the film. So I was absolutely terrified. And that was one of the first things I cut. And I got a lot of really positive feedback from Michael when I showed it to him. So his reaction to it when he saw the cut of it was something that will be embedded in my brain forever. And, you know, so it was that, like having that reaction from him so early when I was so scared. And then also because of De Niro's acting, I mean, because it was like all that nonverbal storytelling was just so exciting to see. And it was just, you know, he was the biggest star of any movie I'd ever, you know, by far of any movie I had cut. And he and Pacino. So it was thrilling, you know, to do it. So it'll always hold a special place in my heart. So that's why I chose it.
I don't think anyone has yet said a better story to me as a massive fan of editors to say, the first scene I cut on a movie was the tunnel scene in Heat. Maybe the best, it's like 2 to 3 minutes. Some of the best 2 to 3, I'm biased, but I don't care. It's 2 to 3 minutes of the best piece of cinema, like visual storytelling that's ever been committed. So you come in, they're in the last day of shooting. When exactly is that? Because this movie with its now 4, because originally 3 and then 4 with yourself coming in and being hired, that's like only a few months really before the movie is premiering, because it's shooting in 95. Okay. It premieres in December. So when was their last day of shooting that you come in to participate in that editorial process?
I think it was in mid-June. It was either June, the middle of June, end of June. Yeah. I don't remember exactly, but it was somewhere middle to the end of June, early July. But I think it was probably more like middle to the end of June. When I went to the set, it was the day they shot the scene with Hank Azaria, where you know, they come into that warehouse and he come into his office and he goes, that's when he says, because he has a great ass and you got your head all the way up. I was on the set that I didn't see them shoot that particular piece of business, but I came to the set, met Michael in his trailer. I think I said like 4 words in the interview. He spoke the entire time. I said like some 4 meaningless words. And then he said, they said, Al Pacino's coming to the set. So he had to go. And he said, is there anything else? He watched a couple of movies of mine and I hadn't done that much. He said, is there anything else you want me to see? He said, well, I said, watch all of what I've done. I'm proud of all of it or something. And then I got the call that I was hired. So it was the easiest interview I've ever had because I didn't have to speak during it. I think he just basically hired me because my friend Chris Girolamo, who was the guy who wrote and directed this television movie I mentioned earlier, Chris said really nice things about me. And I think Michael hired him on his recommendation more than anything. And, you know, so I guess got thrown into the deep end of the pool because, you know, that was the next thing up to edit. And he gave me that, you know, it was the phone call before that too. The phone call between Voight and De Niro on the phone was the beginning of where I started cutting on that. And I remember seeing the dailies and thinking, God, what happened to John Voight? Like, he looked terrible. I mean, I didn't know the makeup and hair was so good. I was like, he, you know, he was a good looking guy, you know? And then I realized it was makeup. So it shows my, you know, I think in a good way, being naive about that kind of stuff makes the suspension of disbelief easier. The first couple of days, I sat in my cutting room almost unable to work. I was so nervous. I mean, you're really scared. You could feel your heart like pounding in your chest. That's all I could think about. And taking deep breaths so I wouldn't like pass out, you know.
I can hear something beating in the mix. I'm not sure what that is. Oh no, wait, it's my heartbeat. It's my heartbeat.
Yeah, I mean, it would seem loud to me, I can tell you that. but yeah, it was surreal, you know, and I remember it so much. Like, you know, you do a lot of movies and some you remember more than others. And that was obviously so a movie that it changed my life, you know, having done that film. And then I all of a sudden started getting offered like big movies as opposed to, you know, smaller stuff. So it was, you know, changed my life for the better in a million ways.
Can I ask you, Billy, I mean, you were just talking a minute ago about seeing De Niro's performance in the dailies in that scene in the car and how kind of meaningful that was. And I will say, as someone who's had the pleasure on two films of getting to sit and watch footage with you and moreover, watch you watch footage, I have never met anyone in my life who is as much of a connoisseur of great acting as you are. I mean, you have this ability to watch footage and sort of find, oh, that's the moment. These are the priceless moments. These are the moments that aren't as necessary. And what De Niro is doing, I mean, that scene's a perfect example of that, because what he's doing is very subtle, right? I mean, it's just the slightest, I want to call it a smile. Do you even think of that as a smile? The little facial expression he's making?
Tiniest of wry smiles, yes.
Yeah, would you, and I don't know how that moment was scripted, because it's a hard moment where, right, he's making a very internal decision. There is no line of dialogue that's going to communicate the decision he's making. And the movie isn't telling you why he's making this decision, right? You have to sort of put yourself inside the mind of the character. Can you just talk a little bit about seeing that footage and De Niro's performance and finding that smile and kind of why that moment? Like, what were you looking at and what did you feel about what you were looking at?
Well, I mean, it was twofold. I think I'm pretty sure, and I'd have to ask Michael, but I'm pretty sure that was they shot it one night and Michael
was a reshoot. Yeah. It was the
second
night.
Michael and De Niro felt like they didn't get it. So they went back the next night and did it again. So I knew that they were looking for something in particular that they clearly didn't get in the first night's dailies. And, you know, Michael dictates extensive notes on dailies, you know, and while he's watching them, like almost like free association into a tape recorder, and then it gets transcribed. And I'm sure that that was one of the pieces he pointed out. There are probably several. So he kind of narrowed the playing field, you know, in terms of like what to pick. But anytime I do that, anytime I'm picking a piece of acting, it's like I just try to make myself the audience and pick what I think is the best. And luckily for me, I think I trained with Michael Kahn, you know, Steven Spielberg's editor, and I worked on some really good films while I was coming up with good acting, and I got to know the difference between what's good and what's not. You know, I think working with Michael and Steven really helped a lot. And then, you know, and then I guess some of it's instinct. I don't know. I just pick what affects me the most, you know, like, and I, you know, that I knew there were a few different choices of that smile or that moment. And it was the one that made me, I don't know. I just get a feeling it's hard. It's instinctual. I just get a feeling of like, that feels real to me. You know, that feels like what that guy would do in that minute, you know, and it just hits me in my gut or something. You know, and then I didn't say I think I got way better at it on The Insider, because Michael and I would have these long talks about performance, and he's a genius, and he taught me so much about I don't know, not what to look. He would always talk about finding moments that transcended the film that felt like you were watching reality. And so that's like what I look for in performance. Like, where do I forget I'm watching a movie? And you don't really forget, but there's a part of you that gets like, especially when it's like Benedict or Mark or Rylance or, you know, people like De Niro, Pacino, Val Kilmer, John Voight. I mean, you're already up in the 90th percentile even when they do something bad, you know? So when you see something outstanding on top of that, to me, it really just jumps off the screen.
I think that smile you talked about, and I love, Graham, what you're asking is like, what is the moment that you're finding it out? Is how would this guy act? The smile has always gotten me because it's the one moment where he's almost in this like flood, like a landslide of different emotions that's running over his face. It's one moment where it's like, just for that brief second, can I just not take myself so fucking seriously in this moment and move on? But then it just got like, it's just like a piece of that landscape running down the hill. Like it just goes, it's the smile. And then it's the cascade of how it flows off his face for me when I watch that scene, which is why I can't get enough of it. But I mean, yeah, it's a kind of magical collection of all these like emotions with nothing happening. And to imagine that both of those guys, a De Niro and a Michael Mann, work all night one night and get to the end of the night and go, we didn't get it. That I love those. That the idea that then you go, okay, well, I've got a whole other night to go to. That seems pretty crazy and special as well.
What's I think special is knowing when you do have it. You know what I mean? Like yes. Knowing. I'm sure they. I know they did. You know, they ran that route. You know, and they. I can't remember how many times they did it, but to know, like, okay, now we have it. Now I got. Like for him to have Michael to have that much control as a director, but even almost more impressive is De Niro to know just inside of him without seeing it, that's the one, you know, that's a pretty, it's easier to recognize it from watching it from the outside than it is. I can assure you from knowing it's that way from the inside, it shows what a master he is and Michael too, you know, that. And it takes I've been on a lot of movies where, you know, I haven't been on that many movies where people have been that self-aware to know, okay, we didn't get it. Like, as opposed to, we shot so much stuff, there must be something there, you know, which is usually what happens. Because of time and budget restraints, you don't usually get to go back a second day, especially for, you know, that's not that huge a scene on paper, you know. So just how much you have to master that craft to understand, like, yeah, we got good stuff, we didn't get great stuff. That's pretty special.
Yeah, it's kind of as you said, like the time that you've taken to talk to people like Michael, making movies and talk about performance and instinct. Like after everything that he does and all the preparation, I love the unexpected thing of like, it's got to transcend the moment. We've got to find the reality. Because one thing that Graham told me about working with you, which he sort of chuckled through, but I couldn't wait to ask you about, was if an actor makes a mistake in a scene that Bill is cutting, he is going to, or like some level of like reality comes into that scene. They bumble a line. There's a certain part. We were talking about Mark Strong picking tobacco off of his bottom lip in The Imitation Game. And I remembered the moment because I love Mark. Like Mark Strong is like one of those guys that you're talking about. Yeah. Right? And he just does it. And Graham was mentioning it to me, like explaining it, thinking I didn't know. I go, oh no, when he picks the tobacco off his lip, he's like, yes. How the hell did you remember that? I go, because it's just this just amazing piece of business you don't usually see. And he's like, that's a Bill choice to make that in this scene, like to put him picking the tobacco off his lip. So I want to ask you how you, that craft that you've been honing as an editor for a long time, is that, how do you choose then to sometimes make the mistake or like look at that little bit of breaking reality? Is there a science to it, or is it just like all instinct at this point for you?
No, I think this is something I learned from Michael Kahn, really, or I observed him doing it and basically copied it, which is he always is looking for some, whether it be like a piece, just a piece of visual business that is really interesting to give it like to give the scene a little extra something. And with him, sometimes it's like, you know, two people cross and the way they cross and it, you know, there's whatever, like you see through their legs, and I'm just making something up, but where it's like this unique little piece of business that makes the imperfection of that makes the scene more perfect in a way, makes it feel real, gives it something that's unique and like something you unexpected. And, you know, and like moments like that, I always go for, there's a moment in Seabiscuit where Seabiscuit wins the big match race with War Admiral, and George Wolfe is like waving to the crowd, and the camera does this little like jerk forward, and it's not a movie that's shot handheld or anything, but it felt like, oh, that's what it would really feel like with the excitement in that moment, and it would be like somebody's getting jostled from the cat, those little moments. And there's like a moment in The Insider where in the hotel room where they meet Pacino and De Niro, where there's like a, I think Pacino leans out of focus and then sits back out of focus. And it's like, this feels like, you know, capture, like grab reality in a way. And I'm always looking for those little moments because I feel like it gives, makes things unique, and it has to feel, not feel like it takes you out of the movie, obviously. It feels like it's part of that character, but it's a little tiny uniqueness. I am always looking for those moments, you know, and now I've trained myself. I just see them, you know, I don't have to think about it consciously. I just know that when I see them, I just pull those out and put them in, you know, a special place. I mean, Michael Caine used to literally, when we cut on film, we used to have little things, little pieces of film that he would roll up, and because I got to find a place for this, you know, it's a really cool little thing. I got to find a, you know, because I just think it, those moments of imperfection add like reality that you can't, you know, you just can't manufacture. You can't decide to shoot that, you know, it just happens. So yeah, I constantly am looking for stuff like that all the time.
Yeah, it's interesting, those things that you sort of can't, as you're saying, like that you can't plan. I mean, I remember when you and I were doing Outfit, and there's a little bit where Mark Rylance drops his glasses. And I remember we even joked about it on set where we were like, as soon as he dropped his glasses and then sort of picked him up in character, we all went, oh, Billy is putting that in the movie. Like 100% Mark dropping his glasses. Billy is, that's a, this is a Billy Goldenberg moment.
Yeah, no, I was doing, yeah, we're doing the surgery. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. And then likewise, I mean, there's even a moment, I've actually always wanted to ask you about this, in Heat, not as part of that minute, but the bit where Al Pacino, he's in the hospital after Natalie Portman's character's suicide attempt. He's in the hospital and he's just said goodbye to Diane Venora, and he's going down the stairs. Mm-hmm. He's like, okay, he gets the page that something's going on near the airport. And so he's sort of going out for what's going to be that final sequence. And he gets the page, and there's this little shot of him just walk, he sort of skips down the stairs in this really funny way, and he has both of his hands out to the side in this really odd way. And I don't know if you remember, but that's another thing where I always think, I was watching Heat again the other day in preparation for this and thinking like, oh, that is a Billy Goldenberg moment, like just a weird way of walk, Al Pacino walking down the stairs in a weird awkward way. Is,
well, actually, I didn't cut that scene, so I didn't pick that piece, but I love that piece because you just feel, I think you feel his pulse. It doesn't, he like, he starts down the steps and then he just like speeds up and runs down, you know, he's like hopping, skipping, whatever. I always just like, it's almost, I always thought it felt like, you know, the part of him, just like he thrives on that adrenaline of doing that thing. And that's like, I get to go back into action. And that's, so he gets like, it, as his heart rate goes up, he starts going down the stairs faster. That's the way I always looked at it, just as an audience. Because Pat cut that scene, Pat Buba. And, you know, the whole scene with Diane and they're, when they're, you know, talking and he gets the page. And it's just like, you know, like you could just see how pulled he is towards that police work. Yeah, I mean, it's just exceptional filmmaking, you know. But I didn't pick that piece, but
it was your good ideas in the atmosphere around the office that clearly led all of your colleagues to do that.
I adore that scene. May he rest in peace, the great Pat Buba, who was your
what a wonderful guy. It was heartbreaking.
He's an absolute treasure, such a pleasure to talk to him at the time. And that was his minute, was that scene that we spoke about. And he too had a similar experience where obviously Michael had his instructions about what he wanted to pick. And he said the flow and the chemistry of the scene, when I cut it together, Michael saw it and there were the most minor of adjustments because he just found his way into Diane Venora, who is amazing in this movie. And obviously Al, and that you almost see it sometimes now with people in the contemporary setting with their mobile phone a lot, like they get a text and you're like, it's good. You don't have to read it now. We're just talking. And you can feel them like it's burning a hole in their pocket. You know, he found the rhythm of that scene. He's really proud of it. It's a great scene. Can you please tell, I mean, besides like maybe the scene of the entire film and for about maybe 20 people who were going to be a part of the show, most certainly was the favorite moment of the film. But do you have any other great memories of that you can share with us of like other scenes that you cut or other moments that like made working with Michael, because the Michael's stream of consciousness into notes is now sort of infamous on our show, and we get so excited talking about it. And very recently on another movie that you cut, John Ortiz was talking about being hired by Michael Mann and said he had a meeting with him, much like you didn't say much to Michael Mann to be hired. And he had this great conversation several hours about the character and the motivations. And then the next day he went back to Michael's office on his way to the airport, and there was an 80-page dossier of all the information that Michael had been talking to him typed up. And he's like, that was like the Holy Grail. It was this beautiful thing. So I'd love if you've got experiences like that to share, because, you know, it's a one of a kind experience talking to you, having worked on multiple Mann films, let alone the best.
I remember very early on, you know, I met Michael, it was like my first week, and I was working on the part where Pacino lands in the helicopter at the hotel and he sees De Niro down the alley and the fire trucks cross. And I was working on that, and I had cut it. I pretty much cut it. And then he called me up, and he was on his way to work. He said, you know, we didn't really know each other and he that well. And he called me up. He said, meet me at Broadway Deli, which is where, you know, De Niro and Amy Brenneman had their first conversation. Was that what it was called? The Broadway Deli was on, right? Graham, was on 3rd Street Promenade? Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's what, yeah. Well, it's the same where the location, and Michael went there all the time. They knew him. And he started telling me all that, you know, like he started going through the notes that he had and showing me how his notes worked and what pieces he liked and how, you know, just how it was all laid out. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I've already cut this, you know, and I pretty much cut it. And I was thinking, I think I've used most of these pieces. So I was very proud of myself. And going back, I just remember that moment of like, I was excited, but terrified that he would find out that I cut it before I had the meeting. And I was all this stuff going around in my head, you know, that was like all these conflicting feelings of, you know, excitement to get to work on the footage and fear that he wouldn't like it. And, you know, happy that I seemed to have picked the pieces that he had picked. And that made me feel really good. There was the moment where, when we were on the dubbing stage, and we were, you know, with Michael, we were making changes up until the very last minute. And the scene where they're about to break into the metals factory, but Pacino's, you know, in the truck, and then the guy makes the noise and screws up the whole thing. Well, there's a helicopter shot that comes down on the van that they're in. It comes way down and comes almost on top of the van. And Michael wanted to make it longer. And he said, do we just make that shot longer? And I'll take a look at it. And we were on a flatbed editing machine on film, you know, and he came and looked at it, and he had his finger on the stop button, and he ran the shot, and he said, we should cut right here. And he stopped the chem, and it was on the frame that I had cut it on. He stopped it on that frame, and I was like, I'm in, you know, like I thought I was so excited that, and he looked to turn around and looked at me like, okay, you know, and that was a really, like, those are in my life, that's the monumental moment, you know. I'm trying to think like other things like that. You know, when I cut the scene, when De Niro comes into the hotel, after he, you know, he right at the end of that scene, he pulls off the road, the scene we showed, he pulls off the road and goes to the loading dock, comes into the hotel, and, you know, sneaks past everybody. Well, I put some music, with Michael, you never put music from other movies as temp music. You always put temp music in that can be purchased. Yeah. So it's got to be, you know, world music with no lyrics or whatever, you know, like just music that you can buy. And I didn't know that. So I put music in from another movie. It was the movie with Alec Baldwin and Nicole Kidman, where Alec Baldwin says I can't remember the name of it, where he says
Malice.
Malice, yeah. It was Jerry Goldsmith. And I put that in and showed it to Michael, and then at the end of it, he he had to get up and go to one of the editors' rooms, other editors' rooms, and he took his hand and slammed it on the table and went, "That's exactly what I wanted," and got up and left the room. And I was, again, like, you know, had a mini parade in my room with just me. And because I was so, it was so early in my career, you know, and I didn't feel like as in control of my work as I am now, or as I think I am now. So it was just really, I think of the gratifying moments like that, you know. There's the scene where Amy Brenneman finds out that De Niro, who is the bad guy, and she runs out of the house and runs up the hill.
Yes.
And he tackles her and brings her back down. And Michael said, "I want to use these four pieces of film to make that work," or five pieces, I can't remember. And Tom Rolfe had taken a stab at it. And Tom is just he's passed away, but an incredible editor. And I was just honored to be in the same room as him. And Tom couldn't figure out a way to put it together. And Michael said, "Well, you take a pass at it," to me. And I sat there for a day looking at it. And then I just remember literally going to the bathroom to have a pee. And while I was at the stall, I thought, "Oh, wait a second, I have an idea. Maybe I think I can do it this way." And I did it and it worked. And Michael looked at it and liked it. And then Tom saw it and I got a pat on the back from Tom Rolfe, which was like, you know, another sort of, you know, incredible feeling, because he was a master. And I was there the first time we looked at the scene. The first time we looked at the movie, and I hadn't seen a lot of it because I just come on. We had a screening room set up in the little warehouse thing we had in Santa Monica where we were cutting. We watched the movie and I was so excited about seeing the scene between De Niro and Pacino, because I hadn't seen it. And I was like everybody else, I was like, "Oh my God." So we watched it and it was terrible. I mean, it was just terrible. Michael had decided he didn't want to play any dialogue off camera. He wanted to play. He had picked this take for this line, this take for this line. So it was a lot of like De Niro saying a line, cutting to Pacino for a silent reaction, back to De Niro in a different take saying another line, and a lot of that kind of thing. So it was like, and Dove, no fault of his, did exactly what Michael wanted. And it was just terrible. And at the end of the screening, Michael said to me, "God, the scene between Bob and Al, it wasn't as good as I'd hoped it would be." And I said, "Michael, you just can't cut it like that." I said, "It would play better if you just picked one take and played it without cutting to the other actor and stayed on that actor the whole time. It would be better than the way it is now." I don't know what possessed me to talk like that to him. But, and then that Saturday, Tom and I came in, just the two of us with a couple of assistants, and the other two editors weren't there. And Tom did that, recut that scene in about a little more than half a day, and it never changed. I mean, wow. He cut, and he asked me, he said, "Will you come look at this?" And I was like, excited that he even wanted me to look at it, because he wanted to say, "What do you like better, this or this?" And I watched it, and it was like a whole, I mean, it is what it is now. So, he's using like just two different takes, I think, because they were both over shoulders that were simultaneously shot and the camera pushed in slightly. So Tom cut that, basically recut it in like little less than a day, and it never changed. So I remember, you know, seeing that for the first time and being really excited, you know, just to be like one of the, like literally the second person to see that scene in its current state. So even before Michael did. Those are some memories some of the good memories I had.
It's interesting hearing you talk about that. I mean, it sounds from your description, certainly from other descriptions we've gotten on this show before, that Michael, he shoots so much footage. It is no secret how much footage Michael likes to shoot. But then he's also he has very particular visions of how they might be used that then you'll change pretty frequently. I mean, I always think about that as something in your work with Michael, in your work with Paul Greengrass, and now in the film you're directing now yourself, like how you sort of think about that, balancing oh my God, I want to get all this footage and I want to have a plan for it, but not have too much of a plan for it. Like how I kind of balance out planning for lots of footage versus, you know, we're just going to grab lots and lots of things and then sort of see what happens. Because it seems like you've worked in kind of both media or both ways of, you've worked in both systems, and on maybe your films with Michael, that's a, it's like somewhere in the middle because you shoot all this footage, then you also do have this very specific plan.
Well, with Michael, it's actually in a way, it's more work, but easier in a way, because what you do is, Michael has a very specific way. He tells, you know, he wants to see the scene. I mean, not cut to cut, but pretty, he gives you a lot of notes with these takes. And but what's great is you can send him, you know, show him the version he wants to see, but then anything else you want to do, he's happy to look at it. In fact, he likes looking at, you know. So I would send him, there was a version, there was a scene on in Ali where Ali says, no Vietnamese ever called me the N-word, you know, which is obviously a really famous moment. And
yeah,
I cut the scene the way he had suggested, and then I sent him seven other versions of it because I just kept thinking of different ways to do it. So I sent him seven. I sent him a total of eight. I think it was either seven or nine. I can't remember, but a lot. And he loved it, you know. It ended up being none of those versions, of course, because it evolved. You know, I don't know which version went in first, but then, you know, notes happen and things change and, you know, but so that's, you know, that's makes it easy because you can just, because of the Avid or because of digital editing, you just make copies and copies and copies. But like with Paul Greengrass, he wants to be surprised. You know, he says basically, do whatever you want, like cut it however you want. And in terms of even the whole movie, not just the scene, show me at the end of it, show me a movie that you, how you see it. Don't like take anything out you want, move it around, anything you want to do, just do it. And he goes, I know the footage I shot. If I don't like it, I'll tell you and we'll change it. So that was, I thought at first, when he told me that, I thought it was a setup, you know, like he was, like, I didn't believe that anybody meant that. And then, you know, the first film we did together, before I showed him the film, I think 25 or 30 minutes out of the film before he ever saw it. And he never, you know, it stayed out. That's incredibly freeing because you can't really be wrong so much. It can just be not what he expected, you know. And Catherine Bigelow, because of the three directors who kind of shoot like that, you know. Catherine's just sort of in the middle, you know. I kind of get the sense of how she wanted it, but then I would just do kind of like find pieces that I thought were incredible or really great storytelling pieces or just visually help the story, you know, and just do it. And, you know, and she trusts me. So oftentimes it stays pretty close to the way, I imagined it might, you know, or saw it myself. So it's, Michael Kahn used to say to directors, allow me the opportunity to be wrong.
And
that's think great.
That in my head because, you know, you're not going to push the envelope unless sometimes you push it too far. You know, you have to go past it to come to find it sometimes. So that I've never say those words, but I've, you know, sometimes you try things don't work, you know, but you get other ideas from them. So I think I just have a good enough reputation now to take chances and people know I did it on purpose, I guess. It's like, why did he do that? Well, I'm sure he had a reason, you know, but. Yeah, I figured like you're supposed to bring something to the table, you know, so.
Yeah.
But that's the great thing about, like I said, the digital editing. You just, you know, here's the way you asked for it, but I had an idea. Take a look at this, you know, and sometimes they like it, sometimes they don't.
Can I ask you to take me back to, you see that very original cut of Heat tons of retooling happens. When is the first time that you see the movie in its whole form finished? And what was that moment like for you seeing it as the guy who came on a little bit later than some of the others? You're with a team of guys who are absolutely incredible in their own right. You come in and you watch this whole movie. What was the experience for you like? Were you able to watch it as a consumer, as a viewer, and appreciate what was there? Like, and because at the time, it's a funny movie. Now we talk about Heat when almost 30 years later, and now 29 years later this year, which is crazy. And it's kind of an undeniable masterpiece now. But at the time, there was a weird critical reaction. There's a weird reaction to this movie. It was sort of liked, then loved, and then it kind of cauterized into an undeniable thing. But can you tell me about that experience of watching it for the first time, that one of those first viewings?
Well, I spoke about earlier, the very first viewing was, you know, it was literally the first time this film was assembled into one long film. So, you know, it was like any movie when you see an assembly, you know, every scene's got a beginning, middle, and end, and, you know, things are fat, you know, in terms of like they're too long and things don't work quite the way you thought they were, but would. And Michael and I spent, you know, he shot the shootout. Like, I think he shot it all Steadicam. He shot it all like on sticks, I guess, or, you know, dolly or whatever. And then he, I think, shot it all handheld. I can't remember. He shot it like three different ways, practically. I mean, the whole thing. Wow. It was enormous. And the way it was cut when I first saw it was much different than the way it is now. We went, Michael and I sat together and recut the whole thing together using mostly the Steadicam. And it took a long time to get through it all, obviously. And then I just remember after that, somehow, you know, and Tom had worked on the scene between the two of them, and, you know, everybody was working on their own things. And then, but that took such a long time. And then when we got to a screening after that, it felt like this movie's starting to click in. You know, there's always a moment where you feel like, okay, now I see the movie. And then it sort of gets closer and closer. And then there's a moment where it's sort of like, you feel like, you know, when you're putting a puzzle together and you get that final, you know, click. There was a time somewhere in there where it was like, and we took it to a different theater that wasn't this makeshift theater that was in the back of this warehouse. You know, and then all of a sudden it was like, especially when you're in a new venue, you know, you're not in that same screen room, you're not sitting in front of the Avid, or in that case, the light works, where all of a sudden you see the movie as a movie and not like all these bits, you know. But, and then when we did it, I remember we did it the first like temp dub, just really mixing it and all the, you know, hearing like the shootout in a real theater in 5.1, it was just like overwhelming. Like, I just thought, this is such a cool, I couldn't believe I get to work on this cool movie, you know, like, I mean, it was just. And then Michael, you know, tells stories about stuff, and it was just really exciting, you know, about all the ride-alongs he did. Or, you know, there was a shot in the movie where after Tom Sizemore gets shot, there was a shot of him, a down angle of him with all the blood pouring out of his head that we eventually took out. But Michael told me he was sitting there eating a plate of scrambled eggs on the catering truck. And Sizemore was on the ground, like with the blood and everything, the makeup. And he was like thinking, it didn't look quite right. And he literally told me he took some of the scrambled eggs off the plate and just like shoveled them into the blood and kind of mixed it around so it looked like brains. And it looked amazing. And that's what they shot. But it was there were a couple things like that in the movie where we took them out. There was a shot of Wayne Grow where they made a complete, like, I don't know what they made it out of, a fake head.
Yes.
So when De Niro comes in and shoots him, there was a headshot that we had in the film that was really, I mean, it was very realistic, and it was just too much. So we ended up playing it like where the actual impact is off camera, but then you see him, you know, on the couch, you know.
It's so funny that you share that story, Bill, because like literally my friend who's a screenwriter and an author and a showrunner, Jordan Harper, happens to be working on a new project with the makeup artist who built Wango's head. And he texted me a photo of Kevin Gage and the Kevin Gage Wango head. Like a duo in a photo. And I was like, what was that for? And he explained that exact story, which I'd never heard about before. They said it was fantastic. It was gruesome, but to the point that it was like, this is actually too good. We can't show this.
It really was. And the way it was photographed, and you see, you know, the splat against the wall. I mean, it was just so graphic that I wonder if we would have gotten an NC-17 from it, to be honest. And then one of the security guards in the beginning with the hockey, you know, when they have the hockey mask on, there was the headshot of that too, where he was down on the ground. They put the gun right to his head and, you know, straight, and then shot him in the forehead. And it was just like, it was too graphic, you know. And to Michael's credit, you know, because it looked, you know, on an island, it looked fantastic, but you know, you can't have the audience get up and walk out of the theater, you know.
not in minute seven or whatever it is in that heist where they do eventually take it out. It's only the first 11-14 minutes of the movie.
It's interesting.
Go on, Billy.
I was gonna ask a question. I was gonna say it sort of gets into this question that I imagine you guys talked about a lot in the editing room on this, that there's a version of the movie in which the De Niro character becomes unlikable to the point of detestable, right? Yes. Like, and starting from that initial heist, right? Where innocent people are getting killed from that initial heist, from actions that he set in motion. But the audience never turns on him. At least, and I can't tell you how many times I've seen the movie, and I've never sat at an audience watching it or been on my own watching it where I've turned on him. And I can't quite explain to you why. But it feels to me like hearing you talk about that headshot, I was just thinking, and as you were describing that, I was going, man, if I'd seen the security guard's brain splatter on the pavement, would I develop this antipathy for the De Niro character that would carry throughout the film in a way that I never did? Because it must have taken some great work on all of your parts to stop that hardening in the audience's hearts from happening, right?
Well, I think that, I mean, this is as much a guess as anything, because I know it works that way, but I think a lot of credit obviously goes to De Niro, just because he's that kind of that skilled an actor to be able to I just saw something recently where I felt like, oh my God, only this actor, again, I'll think of it by the time we finish, could make this person. Oh, it's actually the dailies for the next movie I'm going to work on. Matthew McConaughey is playing this character who can be at the beginning of the film was could be unlikable, but he manages to ride the line between rooting for him and then being repulsed by him, which is, you know, and I think a little bit and a lot of it in Heat is because you see he's not just an evil guy, he's a three-dimensional person who, you know, he's lonely, you see he's, you know, a loner, and he's starting to feel the effects of that as he gets older in life. And, you know, the whole relationship with Amy Brenneman, and then being at that dinner at one night where everybody's with their wives and he just feels like he's there he's on his own. And you see him looking at all the couples, and then he goes and calls Amy Brenneman. You see this vulnerability in him, I think, and that makes you kind of root for him. And the same thing, like when we're taking care of Val Kilmer, you know, when Val shows up, or, you know, he comes home and he's asleep, you know, hungover, and calls his wife, you know, calls Ashley Judd and says, you know, you're going to take him back and give him a chance. And, you know, I think there's those moments that make you feel like this is a three-dimensional person who's picked the wrong line of work, you know. I'm thinking that, like, the fact that he's wearing a hockey mask in the beginning and you don't see his face, you know, while he's assassinating people, basically, that I think that probably lends to it too, you know, that, he, you know, if you had seen his face doing it, it would certainly, you know,
If he was finding kind of glee in it, but he's not, the last thing he wants to do.
No, he's so businesslike.
He's
you know?
Just down the line. But it's funny, Graham, you said that, like, why do I love this guy? And I want to go back because I want a completely underrated scene in the movie is actually one now that I've found out that Bill cut, which is the scene where he comes home to Amy Brenneman, Amy Brenneman's Edie, and she discovers, she's like, is that you? Like, it's that. And he says a line, when it rains, you get wet. And that line, like, just the way he just says, you knew the risks, when it rains, you get wet. That's the coldest he is. And I've seen him shoot a man in the head. Now I know he shot his brains out and we didn't see that in the movie. That's the coldest line in this movie is, when it rains, you get wet. Like, his friends, this guy he loved and tried to care for him and not let him, in his own sort of sociopathic way, not let him get involved in this heist. You know, Lane looks after you, you know, don't do this heist. And now it's just if he rains, it gets wet. And you see that that's him, whether it's him hardening himself to it, whether it's him accepting the reality of what it is. And then when Edie loses it and runs up the hill, he then goes and sort of grabs her, but then it becomes this weird, strange grabbing, comforting her. Like, it's such, yeah, like, I think that it's miraculous. And even in a strange way, some people talk about, like, whoever you see first, you're with them. You're with those guys for some weird science. Mm-hmm. You start the movie with them. And this movie balances those perspectives, like, right at the beginning, seeing all these guys together, you're with everyone. And then it just so happens that they're on a collision course, whatever you want to think about that. So
I think, you know, also people, you know, being a bank robber has sort of been romanticized a bit in films, you know. So that, and he's so cool on top of it, as is Val Kilmer and Sizemore. They're such cool dudes that you gotta, you know, you kind of want to be them, you know. I mean, he made it, it seems, yeah, you get to, like, you know, beautiful women and all the money you want, and, you know, and you get to do all these cool, I mean, in a way, it's like every sort of young boy's fantasy to be like the bank robber and, you know, get the girl, I guess. And you know, Michael made it seem pretty sexy, you know, to, like, that bank robbery scene is pretty, you know, up until the time they all get shot up. But, but the, you know, the Brian Eno music, and it just seems like, whoa, what a cool thing to do, you know, until reality hits, you know.
Blake was bringing this up a second ago, and I've always wanted to ask you about it, because every time I have seen Heat, and I cannot tell you how many times that is, I misremember the opening sequence, that the actual movie opens the bit of De Niro at the train station, and then you go right to the domestic scene of Al Pacino and Diane Venora right at home in bed together. And that is, I was just thinking about this the other day. I find that deeply, it's a deeply strange and unexpected thing to do. That's the contrast. It's such a strange, murky opening at the train station in the, you know, kind of blue-black light with De Niro. You don't know who this guy is. What's he doing? He's just a guy on a train station, And then you have, like, a very kind of domestic is the best word I can think of, like a very kind of domestic drama scene of Al Pacino's character at home. And then, correct me if I'm wrong, but then I think you even go into directly into the bit of the other, then they start assembling the pieces for the heist, right? They get the car, they get the ambulance, Val Kilmer buys the charges, the explosives. Had you guys looked at other organizations of that sequence? Like, the juxtaposition there seems so strange and unexpected. We never did. Really?
Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
No, that was my point. Like, it seems so odd. And I want to know how you guys got there.
Well, I mean, I think it's written that way. But, I mean, he goes all the way through and steals the ambulance.
Yeah, he goes through, he steals the ambulance. The last shot of him, shuts the door, he's driving out, and it goes.
Yeah, and then it's... And then it's Pacino, you know, I'm guessing the answer is usually the simplest one, you know, is, my guess is we've introduced Bob and now we want to introduce Al, you know, and that feels like we never talked about it. It never changed. It always felt like, yeah, when we're introducing our two main characters, and you know, this is in my mind, okay, this is how Michael decided to introduce Pacino. I was, well, let's do that. You know, I never really, we never really talked about it or thought about any kind of different construction of that. I will tell you an interesting story, or how great Tom Rolfe's story is. The editor who cut the opening. I cut the explosive scene. I cut the Pacino stuff, like the lovemaking and the stuff with Natalie Portman. And it was a very weird to cut that lovemaking scene because, look, cutting lovemaking scenes in general are horrible because it's so the actors are uncomfortable. It feels uncomfortable to cut it, and I know when I see a love scene, I'm like, oh boy, you know. I don't even know that I cut one that I really love, you know. Anyway, Michael gave me the scene. I cut that scene, the house scene with Pacino and Diane Benora, and then he said, I'm not sure I like the way this is cut. The whole going through the hospital, stealing the ambulance. The explosive scene where Val buys the explosives. He goes, I just take a look at it. I'm not happy with the way this is. And I looked at all the footage and I looked at the way Tom cut it. And I looked at Michael's notes and there were all these shots in there that Michael said, NG, don't use, NG, don't use. And then I watched what Tom did and he used a bunch of those shots. And I said, I can't, there's no way I can make this better. Like, this is great. So Michael came in and he said, show me what you did. And I said, I really haven't done anything, Michael. I think I can only make this worse. I think this is brilliant the way he cut it. And then he watched and he was like, yeah, it's good. And he never changed. You know? I mean, because he just, I don't know if he just needed somebody else to see with the fresh pair of eyes, but it was like, dude, you should be celebrating. I mean, because it was like, he used those little pieces that Michael said not to use, which were like the tighter shots of like the patient or the machines or whatever, like mm-hmm. where it was De Niro's POV. Then he popped straight into like a tight POV off the wide POV. And it just made De Niro seem like he had this, like such a pro, like he saw everything in an eye for every detail. To me, that's what it felt like to me. And I just thought, wow, this guy, like, I'm not there yet as an editor. I couldn't do what he just did. So it was, you know, I was already in awe of Tom, and that made me more in awe of him after I saw that.
But that's so cool though, that it was, first of all, pieces that Michael wasn't necessarily planning on using. And then also that it was, the strangeness of the juxtaposition, as you're describing, is very much on your mind. That the De Niro pieces are so professional, and he's so mysterious, right? You don't really, why is he in the hospital? Oh, is he,
yeah, what's he stealing, getting an ambulance?
Yeah. Is he stealing an ambulance? Oh, he stole an ambulance. Who is this guy? What's he doing? And then maybe this is why I harp on this, because I find it so like bizarre and fascinating, and part of the strangeness that I think makes this movie so endlessly addicting is that then the scene you're cutting to on the Pacino side, the obvious thing that a normal filmmaking team would do is cut to De Niro at a crime scene doing some really professional bit of cop something, right? That is obviously what you do. And what you guys did was much more unexpected and so much stranger. It's the lovemaking scene that you cut and the sort of domestic drama of that, and that you introduce a character who will be known for his, you know, abilities as a detective throughout the film. You're introducing him. It's like a fish out of water thing, but you're introducing him out of water, like in the place where he doesn't belong, which is home. There's something.
In a relationship that's like about to self-destruct, you know.
And it already has the hints in the scene that you cut, Bill, because there's like Graham's talking about, you cut to this scene. He's there. Almost his workmanlike thing is then getting in the suit and getting his his white handled gun, you know, that he getting all of that ready, talking to Natalie Portman's character. But then Justine's already over there like popping a pill. Like, if you've watched the movie 10 times, you might not even clock that moment, but for people who are as obsessed with this movie as I am, it's like, that's the first thing you clock. You're like, she's taking a pill there. And like, she's self-medicating because this isn't working. It's all about to crumble. And then bang, you're out of that house. I got to go. And you're off to, you know, Arizona with Val. and then you pick up Wango. And I want to ask you, because you saw it assembled, what was Wango doing in the bathroom? Why was his shirt off? This is a perennial unanswered question.
I don't know. I really don't.
May he rest in peace, the great Tom Rolfe. But if I was asking him, I was like, please, was there a shot of him like washing himself in a sink or some weird thing? But so many people are like, Blake, if you ever talk to someone who can know this, why was Wango shirtless in that bathroom? What was he doing?
No clue. It was so cool. I never even thought about it. Like, you know, because everything was so, I was so like wide-eyed on that movie that I just thought I'd never seen footage like that as an editor. I mean, yes, not even close. It was as cool and, you know, interesting in LA, but parts of LA no one had ever seen, no, that I've never seen before, you know. So I don't really know. There used to be a scene with Sizemore buying the hockey masks.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that got lifted. Only a couple, that scene and one other little scene got lifted. Everything else was in the movie. Yeah, just for time, I think it was Tom Sizemore buying hockey mask, and I think the cashier asked him like, why he's buying five whatever hockey masks, and he kind of grumbled something. I don't remember, but there was a little piece of business with Tom Sizemore buying the masks. But I guess Michael felt like we didn't need it, so it went away.
Yeah, because the Val, so Christian Hill is buying the shape charge, has that great exchange between him and the clerk who looks at him, and you feel like he clocks that this is a lie.
Yeah.
Like the clerk puts his glasses on his head and looks at him and looks at the ID it's almost like, I know this is a really good fake ID and this is going to be so much more problem for me if I suspect something, because this guy looks serious, that he then just sells it to him. But you see, there's that beautiful tension in that exchange of like, this is going to be a problem if I don't just sell it to him. It's fine. I'll sell it to him. I don't need to know what he's going to do with this stuff.
By the way, Grim, all I'm going to think about is why. Like, I'm trying to, in my head, I'm spinning like, maybe it's because we literally never discussed it. Like,
well, and isn't that one of the, I always think that's one of the fascinating things about this process, that sometimes I remember learning something from someone years ago. There are people I've worked with besides Billy who I've learned things from. There aren't many, but there's a couple. but most of what I've learned comes from Billy, who was saying to me, like, someone said to me once, and it always stuck with me, you know, don't worry, don't try to develop a style. Don't sort of think about, oh, what's my style? How do I do things? How do I make interesting choices? Just make the choices that feel right to you, and a style will develop. Like, they will be interesting. If you get inside your own head about it and sort of try too much to do something unexpected, it doesn't land and you're sort of phoning it in. But it was like, it's something like that. It's a decision like that that as you were just talking about, it just sort of felt right to all of you. So you just did it. No one was self-consciously going, this is a really odd and unexpected choice. And then it's, you know, 29 years later, you look back on it and you're like, oh, that was a really odd thing to do. It didn't feel odd. It just felt like, good to all of us, right?
I feel like I want to call Michael after we get off, you know? Like, what was the deal? Graham wants to know. No, I mean, either way, I can't tell you how many times but where you might go say, oh, we need to change this, get here faster, or whatever it was. And I would say, well, why don't we just like lose these two cuts and go from here to here? It'll work. He goes, yeah, but that would be what everybody would expect. You know, it was accomplishing the note, but it was doing it in the pedestrian, what he looked at as a pat or a pedestrian kind of way. He wanted to do things in the most interesting way possible, but in a way that wasn't really calling super attention to itself. So something unique, but not unique enough or weird enough to pull you out of the film. But he always wanted to, he always would push the envelope of how do we do this in a way that's more interesting, better, but not self-conscious. And so that was, and it was great, a great challenge, you know, because you would do stuff where you knew he was going to go, no, not like that. So you, it pushed you to do, you know, different, more interesting work, you know. And I think I learned, hopefully have carried that forward, because I think you can do like cutting just in a slightly unexpected place or at unexpected time can give the cuts a little bit more of a life than they might have. If the audience gets into that rhythm, then it feels predictable. But if you alter the rhythm too much, then it feels weird and you're not telling the story. So it's finding that line of some doing it in a unique way, but isn't self-conscious. So, and Michael, that's something, I mean, I've learned so much from him, you know, storytelling wise and editing wise and whatever, you know, just many things that, you know, but you know how, like when you working with somebody, they'll say 1,000 things and 5 or 10 of those things you'll remember for the rest of your life. And with Michael, I have a lot of those things floating around in my head, you know, that hearing his words in my head while I'm doing stuff now, you know. You know, like the end of The Insider, we had time, you know, we went through the whole movie looking to take cuts out. Like, where can we make longer held performance? You know, like, do we really, is that's the same take there and there's a cutaway and it's the same take? Do we need the cutaway? You know, like, and we examined the whole movie that way. And, you know, probably made a half a dozen times where we uncut things because of the strength of a held performance. And even though, like, and sometimes it would even be like there were two different takes on either side, but we would look at is it better just to hold the one performance? And even though the performance of the other end of the other piece might be 2% better, but is it better to just hold the one take and have one held performance? So the integrity of that oftentimes is better for the movie than cutting to get around to a different performance that might not be so much better. That makes sense.
It does. It's funny hearing you say that. I remember perhaps you passed it forward. I remember one of the things that you said to me when we were doing Imitation years ago that I remember so vividly is you were watching a piece of Cumberbatch doing something and you held on him for a really long time. And I was like, oh, that's a really long time. That's a long shot. And you were like, well, I remember so vividly what you said. You said, well, look, Graham, you need a reason to cut. You're not giving me, there's no reason to cut here. Why am I cutting? This is what I want to watch. I'm just watching this. And I think that's so, I think about that all the time. Sort of like, you need a reason to cut. And if there isn't one, just stay here. Just keep watching this.
And if the held performance, as you call it, I love that phrase, the held performance is Benedict Cumberbatch, like crushing it as Alan Turing, just leave the camera on him. Like it's pretty hard to take your eyes off him in that movie. You know, so that's so cool.
Are you talking, is it the scene in the cell with
yeah.
Yeah,
that with Rory, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, who's such a great actor. I mean,
I know, and we kept being like, "Oh, we should cut to Rory," and then you were like, "No, I just yes, Rory's great, and he is great, but it just holds. There's no reason to cut away from this, and this is the story. The story's on his face."
Yeah, no, I mean, it was those are like such phenomenal. I mean, you don't get those moments from a lot of actors, and like with Benedict or Pacino or Russell Crowe or, you know, De Niro, like it is such a gift to have performances like that. Just as an audience, when Benedict did that scene, I was like, I could have watched those dailies 100 times, you know, because he's so exceptionally good that it doesn't come past me that often that you see somebody that good that you can hold for like 2.5 minutes or whatever it is. I think I can't remember on him. It's you know, credit to him and Morton and the DP, because all I did was basically cut the slates off. but yeah, I mean, I'm even in film school. I mean, we'd turn in a film and we'd have to write out like what's the motivation? Why this shot? Why this cut? What's the what's the reason for every cut? You know, and it feels like that may be the one thing I learned in film school. things have that motivation to change angles, is to mean something, as opposed to, and sometimes it might mean it's going really slow and you want the scene to go faster, but there has to be a reason. So it's particularly thrilling to get long performances like that. It's so infrequent these days to get a long held performance that, you know, that you get to just watch.
It's kind of miraculous that you say Heat was your first big movie, which you got offered to do. And then 4 years later, you do The Insider, which I spoke to Graham about maybe blasphemously on this program about that on any given day with great filmmakers that you love, you put on what you think are probably maybe your top one, two. And I think with Michael, it's like top seven films. But I truly think that on its day, when I watch The Insider, I think it might be one of the best American movies not only ever made, and maybe it's Michael's best movie, and your work in it, and particularly my favorite scene of that entire movie, and maybe my favorite scene of anything in 1999, again, possibly blasphemous to people listening, is Russell Crowe at a golf course as Jeff Wigand. that is an editing school. We talk about the acting school of Pacino and De Niro and the gestures and that one take and cutting between them and not, and having dialogue happening that's being said off camera, and the intuition of that 1970s Alan Pakula peak paranoia trilogy in 6 minutes of Jeff Wigand at a driving range is one of the most miraculous scenes I think I've ever seen on film. I've watched it probably a million times, maybe slightly under a million, but let's say 900,000 times. Could you just spoil us with talking about The Insider for 5 seconds, please?
Sure. Actually, I'm so happy you picked a scene that I cut because Paul Rubel and David Rosenblum and I cut that together, and it was mostly Paul and I. David came on for a few months, but that was, it was again phenomenal footage, and that's why I like just talking to directors and hearing about hearing their intentions, and hearing them talk about the story, and hearing them talk about motive, especially when the writer directors, like we did on The Outfit. He just, having the director's voice in my head, means so much, as opposed to I want you to cut from out to this shot, because tell me what I've said to directors before, tell me how you want to feel.
Yeah,
because like telling me the shots doesn't help me. Like, what do you want to feel? And, I appreciate you saying that. I mean, it was such a cool scene to do because of, again, nonverbal storytelling, is really always really fun. And I just thought, I remember picking that first shot, it just looks like you're like a night sky with stars in it. And then it turns out it's, the driving range. I don't know. Like I was very proud of that scene because I picked the music. It's Arvo Pärt, who's an Estonian composer, who I was doing this other film and somebody turned me on to him. And then I just thought that found a piece of music that I thought really worked, and they ended up buying it, which I was, very excited that I picked something that Michael thought was good enough to act, and it's in the movie. So I was almost more proud of that moment than the actual editing, but, it was just really, fun to do because, I mean, the guy driving golf balls in a full suit like that, the guy, it was just like, we don't even really know if he was watching Wigand or just some guy in a driving range. But I just think Michael's choice to put that guy in a suit is just like, it's just genius, it makes it so unusual that he's wearing a suit jacket and a tie while he's driving golf balls, that it just adds extra weirdness to it. I mean, I don't know. It was, And making Russell look like he can golf was a challenge because he was okay. and he worked hard at it, but you know, you got to make the actors look like they know what they're doing, you know? So yeah, that was, it was special to do that. That film, I love Heat and I think it's masterpiece, but I think The Insider is Michael's best movie. I just think to make that story into a thriller, that whole, that, and you know, that really holds and like that, it's a real achievement. I mean, I just think, and the way Dante shot it and, you know, just beautiful. And what's his name? Christopher Plummer as Mike Wallace. And
yeah.
And it's just such great casting.
It's a murderer's row. I mean, even Bruce McGill for 5 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Bless the internet for just constantly reminding everyone how awesome Bruce McGill is.
Oh, I know. After
he had like, the story is apparently he had some kind of like stomach surgery or something like that. And he broke his stitches open doing that scene because of the ferocity of that. Wipe that smile off your face. You know, like that's just 20.
It was great. Yeah, I didn't cut that scene, but when we saw his dailies, I didn't know who they had cast. We saw his daily. Oh, we were all in the cutting. We just kept calling him D-Day, you know, because he plays D-Day in Animal House, which is shocking because he looks completely different. But we were so excited that it was D-Day in the movie, you know. That was. You probably know this, is that scene was shot in the actual court, in the actual courtroom that the actual real testimony took place, and the stenographer was the real stenographer. Wow. You know, Paul Greengrass does that, Catherine does that, you know, using real people to fill out it just makes such a huge difference. In you know, when you're shooting like hyper real stuff like they do, it makes the film, it just feels and you know, smell the authenticity, you know, when they do that. Again, like an incredible movie to be a part of. I remember reading the script and I called Michael and I said, well done or something. I said, this script's perfect. Eric Roth wrote the script, the original script, and it's just so on the nose. I mean, so perfectly done, and to make it into I did suggest, so one of the only times I asked Michael for a shot was in that where, we didn't have an insert of the bullet in the mailbox. I was like, Michael, you got to have an insert of the bullet in the mailbox. And he shot it, but then he, of course, came up with the idea to take the back of the mailbox off and shoot through the mailbox and see the bullet in the foreground, which, of course, I would have never thought of in a million years, which made it, you know, there's all kinds of funny memes of you. I don't know if you've ever seen, there's one, somebody took that scene and when Wygan looks in the mailbox, there's a dildo in the mailbox, small dildo. You know, it's out there on the internet. I've seen it. You know, and then when I cut that scene where she gets, you know, he finds the bullet while she's downstairs getting there, we're going to fucking kill all of you, and the message in the email. Lisa Gerard, who did the music for that movie, she would like compose things based on the script.
Yes.
A lot of that music was done beforehand, you know, so she said that cue is called Faith, and she sent that, and I had literally an audio cassette of it, and right as I was cutting that scene, she sent that, and we received that piece of music. I put it in the tape player, and I was like, I'm going to put this right in the scene right now. That was literally, it was like, talk about half the presses. I literally just received it, put it in the scene, and it stayed there. So it was just a weird coincidence of like, she happened to write this piece of music. It was just not even for that scene. It was just for the movie. And it dropped into the scene perfectly and stayed there. So it was like one of those serendipitous things, like it happened that way for a reason, I'm sure. It was funny because Russell Crowe was so spot on that movie. He was every take was phenomenal. Like there wasn't a bad piece of film of him. And Pacino, who was, same thing could be said about his performance in Heat, even though like one take he'd be whispering and one take he'd be screaming, Pacino, he would give you the full variety sometimes, like the scene where he comes home and Ralph is there, you know, the he takes the
Xander
TV.
Berkeley.
Yeah, he's great, Xander. Al did takes that were really subdued, and he did what's in the movie, like all, he ran the gamut, and he was just like total control of everything he did. And on The Insider, I think he had a much harder time finding the part, you know, and there were scenes where he, like the Japanese restaurant scene, right in the middle of one of the takes, he just couldn't find it, it felt like. I mean, I never spoke to him about it, so I can't say what was going on in his head, but at one point, he just, in the middle of a take, he's put his head down on the table, like in the middle of the take, and Michael didn't want to disturb him, you know, because it's Al Pacino, and after about 30 seconds, which seemed like an hour, you know, because when something like that happens, he was like, he heard Michael off camera go, Al, he just wanted to make sure he was okay, you know, like physically, and then Al popped his head up and went right back into the take. He just started acting again after like 30 seconds with his head down on the table. It was the weirdest thing. And there were some of the phone calls where, like, we did some of the phone calls in that scene were shot simultaneously, you know, without being filmed the same time Russell was. And some of them, you know, you had the script supervisor reading the lines, the off-camera lines. And when it was that, Al, it's such a hard time with the scenes. Like, I mean, they obviously came out great, so the performance was there, but it took a lot of digging and crafting where when they were on the phone together, it was like so electric. When the scene where Weigand's in the hallway of the school and he's in his office and he says, it doesn't matter whether you tell the truth or not.
Yes.
You know, which is one of my favorite scenes in the movie. They were on the phone together, you know, like really on the phone, and they had the tracks, you know, their dialogue was recorded separately. So yeah, it's complete separation. And I didn't cut that scene, but it's just electric because they're actually on the phone together. And, you know, like when I did this movie last year called Air, you know, the movie about the Nike, you know, signing Michael Jordan.
Yes.
And there were a ton of phone calls in that. And we did, and Ben Affleck, who directed it, did the same thing. And it makes the scene so much better when they do that. And Al's performance is fantastic in the film, but it was clearly someone who was trying to, you know, dial it in a lot of the time, where Russell was just like exceptional in everything, you know.
He was right in that purple patch. It was about to be a passing of the torch almost, you know. Russell was idolized those guys like nothing else. So for him to work with Michael and work alongside Al, like he had to bring his A game. Like he was like, I'm across from Al Pacino. If I mess this up, Al Pacino and everyone else in that movie, if I mess this up, this is it.
I've heard Russell interviewed about him being cast in that movie, and it's interesting, just like how he's like, you know, that guy's 48 or whatever, and I'm 27. You know, I was like, and I don't look any, and it was just the idea that Michael even thought about casting it.
Yes.
You know, I don't know if it was him or I can't remember who the casting director is, but you know, it's just those choices like that are like, they seem so, like looking back, it's like, wow, what a brilliant thing to do to cast him in that, because you would never think of him. And like those, like moments like that in movie history where somebody was, you know, a totally unexpected choice, which is such the right choice. It's like, it really does live on, you know, live on forever, those kind of things.
I think you and I have talked about that over the years, that like with casting, you either want to go perfectly with type or perfectly against type. And Russell Crowe in The Outsider is perfectly against type. It is the exact opposite of what you expect from him. And that's what works. It's where and you get into trouble when you try and go in the middle. When you try and go like 30% off type, it just ends up being a mush. But like 100%, 180 degrees off type is amazing. It's like cast the exact wrong person and you get something brilliant.
Yeah, so it's even in Ferrari with Adam Driver. It's like it's such a weird 100%. Why would you younger? You know, you may be an older guy. He's meant to be Italian, etc. But I think Adam does a brilliant job in that movie. He's brilliant in that movie, and only going to grow and be great. So that's funny that you said 30%. How did you phrase that? Graham was like 30% off is a wash. You can't.
It doesn't work. You either go, you don't want to get someone who's like almost right for it. You want to get someone who's perfect or not right at all. And both of those have creative value, but almost just ends up being this muddle.
Well, you have to, like, people who make those decisions, and you know, like when they cast Johnny Depp as Jack Sparrow, like no one wanted that. And then when they saw how he was going to play it, they really didn't want it, you know. And then credit to Jerry and Gore, you know, Verbinski, just to hang in there and say, nope, I know everyone thinks we're wrong, but we think we're right. And to take that, it's hard. That takes a lot of spine that I don't know that I have, you know, like if that many people came to me and said, that's not right, it's really hard to stick to your guns and say, nope, I believe in this, I'm doing it. Especially when there's, you know, millions of dollars at risk, you know.
Just before I let you go, and it's so serendipitous that I picked a scene that you cut in The Insider, but we have an ongoing show called Miami Nice, where we talk about Miami Vice from 2006, which has been reclaimed as the masterpiece that it is. And I just want to ask you about, like, a highlight scene in that movie, and a scene that feels to me maybe like a you scene is a scene that where they're talking to Eddie Marsan. Sorry, I lost his name.
He's awesome.
Who is amazing in Eddie Marsan, Nicholas's apartment, where all the characters are around and they're sort of trying to break into this international crime syndicate. Is that a Billy scene?
I did cut that scene. It was super fun. Eddie is awesome. I worked in another movie with him. We played a brain surgeon. So to show you his range. The dialogue was so great in that scene in terms of like this insulting him and him being like wired and off, you know, off the chain and stuff. It made it really fun to cut. And what's her name? Harris, and Naomi Harris.
She was, and
Gina Rodriguez, I think.
Yeah.
They were both, the women were so good.
Elizabeth Rodriguez. Yeah. Her character's name's Gina. So yeah.
Yeah, there you go. That's,
yeah, there you go.
That was so, it was so much fun to cut. And the apartment was like crazy, you know, like huge and over the top, and you know, it was just those scenes are so fun, like that, when the dialogue is like that and the acting is so good. I mean, he's such a good actor. I mean, he's the disappearance, what's it called, the disappearance of
Alice Creed, yeah, the Jay Blakeson movie.
Yeah, he's so good in that, you know. He's a really underrated actor.
He's been in so much too, and he's just good in everything.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that, you know, he's so good and nobody ever remembers his name. You know? Like, it's kind of like Michael Stuhlbarg a little bit, you know, where he's great at everything he does.
Yes.
And nobody ever knows his name.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he's played so many different kinds of characters. He's almost like, somebody was saying to me, who's really good friends with Michael Stuhlbarg, he's almost too good. You know what I mean? Like, that he's so good that he becomes that character so much that nobody remembers him, you know? Eddie's like that. It was super fun because I remember, sitting here watching somebody.
Marlon's highlights on your flat screen.
Yeah, you're that big. Yeah, that's great. That's great. And it was all that stuff with him was just electric. And I'm glad people have come back to that film. You know, I've read some articles recently about how people now appreciate it, because it's almost like the movie shouldn't have been called Miami Vice.
Yeah.
You know, because it's like everybody expected one thing and Michael gave him another and they didn't want it, you know. They just expected it to be sort of like that tongue-in-cheek stuff that was, you know, that was the TV show. And that's not what Michael made, you know. So it, I think, took people so off guard that it took all this time to sort of appreciate it. But Michael's movies seem to have such a long shelf life that, like, I don't even think Heat made all that much money when it came out.
It didn't.
I mean, it made kind of what it cost, but then they're 29 years later, here we are. So Michael, it shows, you know, what a genius he is, because he's kind of ahead of his time. Like, how many painters have died poor and now they're, you know, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars for one of their canvases. So Michael's like that. It's pretty incredible.
Well, I want to firstly just say a massive thank you to Graham. And Graham, I hope that you, as a person who also had restraint, because you actually had work to do, you know, making the outfit together and making Imitation, to, you had the burden was on actually making a great movie at the time and restraining yourself for Heat and Michael Mann's storytelling until now, this very moment that we're together with Billy. So I hope this has been fun for you, because thank you so much for making this happen. And you being here has been extra special, because I feel like the insights that you can give as a filmmaker yourself are just amazing. So thank you.
It's my pleasure. I'm glad that, yeah, not only did I hold back on asking Billy questions through that process, I give Billy a lot of credit for not, few and far between were the times that we'd be working on something. And I would say, Billy, can you do it this way? And you'd say, well, Graham, having edited Heat, no, I'm not going to do the dumb thing you're suggesting. I'm not going to say you never did it. I'm just going to say you were really gentle about not doing that too often. And I've always been grateful to you for it.
You know, I never said that. And but I did work with an editor who...
But you could have. You could have.
I did work with an editor who used to say, I can't even come close to saying who he was and who he's referring to, who did say that to a director. Well, this is the way so-and-so would have done it. Like, talking about the director that he worked with. And I would be like, yeah, so? It doesn't make it right. That doesn't make what you're saying right. But I didn't want to, you know, I was far be it from me to, like, get involved. But I did experience that once. But I just hope, if any, whoever's listening knows that I did not say the way it should be.
I just think that everyone listening absolutely undeniably thinks that that's the fairest thing you could possibly say. Well, I did cut Heat, so I think I know what I'm talking. I also think the bigger flex maybe is The Insider. I did cut The Insider, so, you know, I think I know what I'm doing.
I don't do a lot of flexing, I gotta tell you.
No, look, this is, we just allow us to heap potential flexes upon you while we're talking to you. But and finally, Billy, Mr. Goldenberg, this has been a true treat. You've been such a person I've wanted to talk to for an immensely long time. And that's why I can't ever really truly close the door. I like Neil McCauley, have a code. I was never going back, and I've repeatedly broken it. And as my great friend Bill Gabiri says, Blake, he says, you got to go when the Heat is around the corner, but he fucking has coffee with the Heat at a diner. So I'm like that. I feel like the Heat of this movie keeps bringing me back, and the opportunity to talk to you and to hear your stories and to share them now with the people who are going to listen, I'm just incredibly proud and incredibly honored. And I'm just so grateful for your time and your stories. And I'm just going to be giddy and floating on air for the next couple of days thinking about this whole conversation. Well, so thank you so much.
Oh, I appreciate it. And I appreciate you doing what you do, because the fact that people are still talking about the film, or you're talking about Miami Vice, and, you know, a lot of that has to do with people, you know, like you, who appreciate the film so much. And it was so fun to talk about. You know, I don't talk about it that much because it was a long time ago, and it was really fun to think about it. And I appreciate Graham taking the time. I know you're super busy, and I'm just happy to see you, because we haven't seen each other in the several months. You know,
I'm gonna call you tomorrow and start interviewing you about stuff. I'm gonna start asking you questions. This is, now I know how to get to you. Well, I'm the one who's busy. You're finishing your film. Yeah, I have so many more questions.
Oh, please, you know, I bet over drinks.
Well,
but anyway, thank you, and thank you too, Blake. I really appreciate you having me on.
oh, look, to know that you know and that you feel appreciated by the work that I and the contributors of the show have done is huge. So the feeling is very much mutual. I hope that you guys don't have to do more interviews to get together, but if you want to do one on the outfit just so you can catch up, please let me know anytime. Please let me know anytime. But I'm just going to say thank you so much, and I'm going to let our listeners go and recommend going to watch that driving range scene. I'm going to recommend watching the tunnel scene. I'm going to recommend watching all the great films that you've done. We didn't even mention Tony Scott except for in the beginning, Domino. But thank you so much, and thanks everyone for listening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.